Don't you always want to be the best you can be?
The Frankie Boyer Show.
What is this?
It's more than a lifestyle show.
It's a show about living in today's world.
I think something is happening.
Frankie enthusiastically brings an amazing eclectic mix to the airwaves.
You got that right.
One of the reasons she's earned legions of loyal fans is very simple. When you listen to the Frankie Boyer Show, you just never know what's going to happen next.
So listen for yourself.
Here is Frankie Boyer.
And it is a pleasure. Welcome to the program. This is Frankie Boyer. And I have to tell you, I had the good fortune of interviewing Dr. Stuart Jameson yesterday on my health show. And I'm so thrilled he's back for this show, for Biz Talk Radio, because I think everyone needs to hear his story. An extraordinary man. Dr. Stuart has helped change the way heart transplantation is done in this country. He is the veteran of more than 40,000 heart surgeries, the author of more than 500 scientific papers. More importantly, this is a man that was born in now called Zimbabwe. He escaped his homeland civil war for higher education and medical school at the University of London. He navigated the bush like it was Disneyland. And he's also a professional helicopter pilot. The list goes on and on and on. Where does this extraordinary man get his energy? And today we need to just share that he, of course, he went on to build leading heart and lung transplant centers in Minneapolis and at the University of California, San Diego, where today he is a distinguished professor of surgery and dean of cardiovascular affairs. This book, Close to the Sun, is more than just an autobiography or history. It's how medical science advances. It examines the ingredients of medical breakthroughs and painstaking research. And I'm so excited to have him with us today. And Dr. Stuart Jameson, congratulations on the book, Close to the Sun. And what a life you have and what a career you have.
Yeah, thank you, Frankie. Good morning. Well, I've been very privileged. You know, it's been fun. The story of heart surgery is one of the greatest stories of the last century. There was no heart surgery when I was born in 1947, and during my lifetime, we've seen heart surgery and indeed transplantation become what it is today, just an everyday event almost done all over the world. And it's been a real privilege to be involved a little bit in the development of that. And I've been very lucky. I've had a remarkable life. I was born, as you said, in Zimbabwe, which is the other side of the world to here. And then I always had a passion for being a doctor and a surgeon in particular. And I made my way in the 60s to Britain to go to medical school at the University of London. And it was a difficult time because civil war had broken out in my home country. My father had died. Britain had put sanctions on what was then Rhodesia. And I showed up in London to go to medical school with almost no money. And I paid my way. I made my way through medical school by waiting at tables and tutoring young kids. But it wasn't a very comfortable time because I was poor and hungry most of the time.
Yes.
But it was a wonderful experience, and I loved what I was doing. And in those days, in the early 60s, some of the very first kidney transplants in the world were being done at my hospital, St. Mary's Hospital in the University of London. So I became fascinated with the idea of transplantation, and then in 1967, while I was still a medical student, Christian Barnard from South Africa did the first heart transplant. And then by the early 70s, by the time I was doing my surgical residencies, and I was going into heart surgery. Heart transplantation had pretty much stopped everywhere in the world because the results were so bad. The one place that was still doing heart transplantation and doing it successfully was Stanford University in California. And the chief of the program there was a man called Norman Shumway, just a wonderful, humble, very gifted, nice man. The problem was I wanted to spend a year's fellowship with him to learn about transplantation, to learn about how he was making transplants possible where everybody else couldn't. The problem was he generally didn't take anybody from outside. He would only take people from his own program. Well, I was at the Brompton Hospital in London at the time, and the chief surgeon there, Matt Panneth, who I was working for, had been involved as a resident, as a junior doctor, in the very first heart surgeries in the world in the early 50s that were done at the University of Minnesota. And when he was a resident there, there were two other resident students. One was Norman Shumway from Stanford. The other was Christian Barnard, who went back to Cape Town and did the first heart transplant. So Matt Panneth traded on his old friendship with Norm Shumway and asked him to take me for a year. And so I set off in 1978 for a year's fellowship at Stanford. And I was still poor, of course, but I cajoled the British Heart Foundation to give me a fellowship for a year for $12,000. And even then, I mean, $12,000 didn't go very far by the time.
No, I'm sure.
Clothes and food. But I bought a bicycle, and I lived the other side of the tract in a poor part of town. And my first 6 months at Stanford, I was just a very junior doctor on the wards. And then in July of 1978, Shumway asked me to work in the Stanford laboratories for a while. And we started looking at various drugs, immunosuppressive drugs, that would stop rejection. And, you know, doing the transplant of any organ is relatively easy. The physical part of doing the transplant, that in and of itself is not a tremendously big deal. The difficulty to achieve successful transplantation comes in the post-operative care, where you have somebody else's organ inside of you, and the body is programmed to get rid of anything foreign. So if you get a splinter in your finger, your body will eventually remove it, get rid of it. If you get flu or measles or bacterial infection, your body is programmed to fight that. And in exactly the same way, it's programmed to fight a heart transplant because it recognizes it doesn't belong to you. And the key is to try and achieve some sort of immunosuppression in which you can tolerate and live with your organ transplant, but still have the ability to mount a defense for the everyday infections all of us are in contact with. And we were very lucky. In 1978 and 79, we were using a drug that was much better than everything else we'd used before. It allowed almost normal healing of the tissues, because one of the main ways that these immunosuppressive agents work is to suppress the body's ability to produce these agents which fight against the organ, the white cells, the platelets, the various things in your blood. And they're all toxic to the body, of course. You weigh up the toxicity to the body versus the ability not to reject the organ. But one of the things it does, too, is that it interferes with the healing of the tissues. And after you've just done major surgery, you really want the tissues to heal. But anyway, the heart transplantation then became much more tolerated. But the most exciting part of the story, probably in the late 78, was that we started to look at lung transplantation. And lung transplantation up until that point had never been possible. There had been.
I'm going to let you continue. We need to take a quick break, but when we come back, yes, I'll let you continue the story. That's why I wanted you on for a double segment. There's just not enough time with one.
Yeah, great. Okay, thank you.
Close to the sun, the journey of a pioneer heart surgeon. And then we're going to find out, when in all of this career did he learn how to become a commercial helicopter pilot, collect and study ancient medical manuscripts and antique watches. We will continue with the most fascinating doctor who changes lives and saves lives with heart transplantation, Dr. Stuart Jameson, right here on the Frankie Boyer Show, Biz Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
41.
Now you can watch business videos on demand. Go to bizvod.com for details. That's bizvod.com.
My love must be a kind of blind love.
I just am so fascinated by our guest that we're talking with today. What a career he has had. What an extraordinary life. I just don't know how he fits it all in. Close to the sun, over 40,000 heart surgeries. That's extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary number. One of the pioneers in lung and heart transplantation and the medicine to allow the body to accept the organs. His new memoir is out. It's more than a memoir, though. It's more than an autobiography. It's really a history. It's called Close to the Sun, beautifully done, the journey of a pioneer heart surgeon that, you know, loves the bush and is familiar with the wildlife and city life. And what a juxtaposition of a life you've had, Dr. Jameson.
Yeah, so when I grew up, as I say in the book, I had a pet zebra and a pet giraffe, and I lived on a big ranch that at the time was what now you would call a game reserve. And the strange thing was, it wasn't until I went away to boarding school at age 8. But until then, I thought everybody in the world lived like that. I hadn't realized, of course, that I was in a remote part of the world, the other side of the world. But it was a great privilege to grow up so close to the animals and get to know the bush so well. And part of the book, as you say, discusses some of the hunting and tracking that I did. There was a man that worked for the ranch who'd been there since 1930, and it was a huge cattle ranch, and he was known as Africa's greatest hunter. And I apprenticed with him because he could attract animals, you know, in a way that we now read books. I mean, every sign is there, but you've got to know what to look for. And so it was a very, very interesting time. But the juxtaposition of then when I went to London was extreme because I think I'd seen one traffic light by the age of 18. I'd never been on an escalator, hadn't watched TV. And suddenly I go to this concrete jungle where it never got quiet and it never got dark.
That
was a big, that was a big transition.
Sure, of course,
But it was worth it. And of course, as I said earlier, then I ended up at Stanford, and I ended up staying at Stanford for a total of 8 years. I was going for a year, but Dr. Shumway asked me to stay, and then I was on the staff, and it was a wonderful time for me because at age 34, he made me the director of heart and lung transplantation. And at that time, in 1982, I was the only person in the world doing heart and lung transplant. So a very privileged position. But more importantly, it gave me a platform to do these pioneering surgeries and to further investigate the drugs that we were using, to the point that now thousands of heart transplants are done every year across the world, and we don't really think much of it. And the other part of the story was that in 1986, the person that did the very first heart surgeries at the University of Minnesota in the 1950s, and who trained my two mentors, Matt Panneth at Brompton in London and Dr. Shumway at Stanford, retired. And I went to take his job. So in 1986, I became chief of heart surgery at the University of Minnesota and a director of the Minnesota Heart and Lung Institute. And so the circle completed itself. I was able to use and learn and capitalize from what my mentors had taught me. And part of the book is talking about these wonderful people, tremendously courageous pioneers.
Yes, yes.
But just like the pioneers in the Wild West, they were going in and doing things that nobody thought was possible, that their careers were on the line, quite aside from the patients' lives. It was a marvelous time, and those individuals are dead now, and I really wanted to write about them and to put down on paper my experiences with them, because they were not ordinary people. I've always said, you cannot do extraordinary things and be an ordinary person. So these people all had their little picadillos. They weren't exactly the person in the street. And I wanted to record that. They were people, and they devoted their lives to making the world a better place.
I have to ask you, when did you learn how to fly a helicopter, and when did you become a commercial helicopter pilot?
So, Frankie, I'd always wanted to fly a helicopter. It seemed a very challenging thing to me. And I love challenges. I love new experiences. And I decided about 20 years ago that I wanted a new challenge. I was going to learn to fly a helicopter. So I did. And like everything, I wasn't satisfied with just learning to fly and getting my private license.
No, of course not, doctor. You needed to go take it to where you could take it, of course.
Exactly. And so I did my commercial license. And yeah, exactly. That's how it worked.
I only have a minute left with you, and I just want to ask you very quickly, where do you see heart transplantation in your crystal ball in 10 years from now, and heart disease and the changes that we're embarking on today? Do you see them happening in 10 years? Do you see a radical difference in the way that medicine is handling the heart?
Yeah, it's a great question, Frankie. You know, when I did my first heart transplant in 1979, and I took this failed switching heart out of somebody's chest, and I looked inside this empty chest of a person still kept alive by the heart-lung machine, I thought, you know, I've reached the pinnacle. I've climbed the mountain. Nothing can beat that. But that wasn't true. Then came lung transplantation. Then came artificial hearts. Now we do microsurgery. We use the robot. There's always something new. And heart surgery is expanding at a rate very similar to the way that cell phones are. I mean, 10 years ago, cell phone looked nothing like what it looks now.
Yes, yes.
And
well, that's good to know. We're
the same way.
We are out of time. Oh, I'm just so thrilled you took the time to chat with us today. The book is just a magnificent piece. It's called Close to the Sun, The Journey of a Pioneer Heart Surgeon. Dr. Stuart Jameson, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Having me, Frankie. Thank you.
And the book is sold wherever books are sold, Amazon, independent booksellers, and we'll be right back. I'm Frankie Boyer. This is BizTalk Radio.
But I can't see a thing.
Biz Talk Radio is powered by Freedom Solar. Find out more at freedomsolar.com. Biz Talk Radio.
And welcome back. It is Frankie Boyer, Biz Talk Radio. Joining us now is Leslie Landis, and she's the author of Shendell. It's a natural warrior fantasy novel with environmental themes, and she's really concerned about the environment, as I am, and I'm so thrilled to have you with us today, Leslie. You say it's incumbent upon everyone on a daily basis to make necessary changes that can save our environment. And, I think it's really important that we talk about the little things that we need to do that turn into really big things, Leslie.
Totally agree with you. And I just want to say thank you for having me on your show, Frankie.
So in Europe, teenage girls and young women are leading a large student environmental movement, and organizers right here in the United States plan to join an international day of action March 15th.
Yes. Yes. And this movement is beginning to become worldwide. And it's, it's so encouraging that young people are the ones that are leading this and making a statement, because it's their future that's at stake here.
Yes. You know, Leslie, I'm always concerned because I live in the city. I live right in the north end of Boston, and it disturbs me and devastates me to see in September, the end of August, the trash, the stuff that's left on the streets, and almost every month, but especially when the students come back and when the students move out, and young millennials. And I see gorgeous things left on the street where people would love to have these possessions. And I don't understand, and I haven't understood, and I scratch my head. Why are they not recycling? Why are they not calling the Salvation Army or St. Vincent de Paul or any of the different organizations to have them come and pick up and bring these goods someplace so they don't sit in the rain in the street and become part of the landfill?
Well, I think that, we've all been submerged, raised, whatever, in a throwaway society, a convenience society. You know, this is the way too many of us have lived our lives, and it hasn't really sunk in that we can't continue to keep living this way, to keep doing things the same old way.
Yes. It's very sad. So I know that we've tried in my neighborhood, and it's been a major success. There's a compost, because you can't, it's really hard to do it in the city, but we have a central location outside the youth center in our neighborhood where you can bring your compost.
That's incredible. That's a terrific thing.
Yeah. And I know in my building, and I've shared this numerous times on the air, we have, I live in a condo in the city, and we have in our trash room a shelving unit, and whatever we don't want, from magazines to lamps to whatever it is you don't want, you're not using, it gets recycled. And there are a lot of people that live in the building and people that work in the building, and so everyone gets to take advantage of it, and books and everything. It's a wonderful idea.
That is a wonderful idea. I think that kind of thing is what boosts the consciousness for people of the importance of this and how easy it really can be. And it just spreads the idea.
Yeah, it really does. It absolutely does. Give us some of the other recommendations that you can share with us.
Well, I think a lot of them are just common sense things. Instead of constantly taking a new water bottle, new plastic one, use a reusable water bottle. You know, pour water into one that you take with you and you clean out every now and then.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's a big movement. I live in California. There's a big movement here to stop using plastic straws.
Same. Oh, yes. Yes. It's a big movement. We actually have a ban in Boston that you can't use a plastic bag anymore. No one is
That's
allowed
great.
To give out plastic bags anymore. You have to either bring your own bag or buy a bag. But no more plastic.
I was just going to mention that, how important that is. Do you know they actually
But you know,
found,
Leslie, yeah. you know, Leslie, 18 years ago, I was visiting a friend in Boulder. 18 years ago, if not longer. And we went into a store, and I needed something. And after the transaction, I gave the money, and the woman looked at me, and I said, "Do you have a bag?" She looked at me like I had 10 heads. This 18 years, she says, "No, we don't have any bags. We don't use bags here." So my friend was horrified. She said, "No, we don't use bags. You don't need a bag. It's just, we'll just go right to the car." But, you know, we're so trained to have a bag. We are so trained to use bags. It's so funny. I'll never forget that. But that was 18 years ago. Boulder was not using bags. They were like, "No, we're not using. We don't use bags."
Unfortunately, these ideas take a long time to spread, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They do. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, my book is, it has a superhero. And, you know, I feel that the superhero is an expression of our best desires to solve our worst nightmares. So I thought, why not solve a real world problem, which happens to be environmental degradation? To me, that's an incredible problem and probably the most important one of our times. And so I have a superhero that actually fights for the environment, for nature. So that makes it very different to begin with. Instead of somebody who's trying to save the world from someone who's trying to take over the world, this my superhero is trying to save the world from all of us, from all the things that we do.
Yes, yes. I love that. I love that. So what do we need to do to keep this awareness about the environment?
Well, I hope that my book is a small contribution to this. I think that we have to join marches and causes, such as the one that's coming up on March 15th, and it is spread to the U.S. here, too. I think that we have to, by example is the most important thing, and by changing our own personal habits. And finally, I would suggest that we really press our representatives in whatever level of government to make changes in the laws that will encourage everybody to live a more environmental and ecologically safe
yes,
life.
Yes, yes, yes. I know the plastics are just a real problem for our ocean. They say that now the debris islands are popping up all over the ocean filled with plasticides. The fish, the birds are dying, eating them, thinking they're food. It's so ridiculous what's happening, and we really do need to wake up. We just need to wake up about this.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, and we are eating those same creatures, so we're ingesting some of it because the plastic breaks down into microfibers.
That's right. That's right. It does. And it's changing wildlife. It's changing everything. It's really just so amazing. I just don't know what we do about plastic anymore. I just don't know what the answer is. I know that I'm so thrilled that Boston has adopted a no plastic bag law, but there's still so much. I mean, we have so far to go. And you said it brilliantly, Leslie, when you first came on, we are a disposable world. Everything is like, let's just throw it away, let's just tear it down, let's just dispose of it.
Exactly. And, you know, there used to be a time, I've had people who, you know, are much older point out an earlier time when there was just paper bags, and in fact, things were put in boxes. And somehow or other, we all got along. It worked.
It did work.
There's no reason why we can't go back to those things.
Or, I mean, I go to my big trade show, and all of the bags that are given out that we use, it's burlap and hemp, and they're all sustainable and makes a huge difference.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I'm hopeful that we're becoming aware of this, that people are beginning to catch on.
I hope so too, and I thank you for your book. I thank you for the work that you're doing. And anyone can be a hero, you say, in the fight to save our environment and ultimately our world. Leslie, what's the best website, please?
Chendell.com. That's Chendell.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
And we have enjoyed you, and we'll be back in just a moment. This is Frankie Boyer. You're listening to us on Biz Talk Radio, biztalkradio.com.
This is Biz Talk Radio, America's home for business talk. Online at biztalkradio.com.
And welcome back. Joining us now is Mark Lesser. Mark Lesser is a CEO, Zen teacher, author, leads trainings and talks worldwide. He has led mindfulness and emotional intelligence programs at many of the world's leading business and organizations, including Google and Kaiser. He is currently CEO of ZBA Associates, a company that provides mindfulness-based leadership training. And it is such a pleasure. And you have a new book out. It's called 7 Practices of a Mindful Leader, Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you've been many things. You've been a dishwasher. You've been a baker. You've been a startup entrepreneur, CEO. Tell us the connection about the practices and why you were able to succeed.
Yeah, you know, I had the kind of unexpected path of, my 1 year leave of absence from college when I was in my early 20s turned into 10 years of living at the San Francisco Zen Center. And what was really surprising to me was that I kept being asked to take on greater leadership roles within that organization, and my eighth year in, I was running a kitchen, which was a lot like a high pressured commercial kitchen, and my 10th year, I was the director of a place called Tassajara, which is a Zen monastery in the winter, and then in the summer it turns into a resort and conference center, and I kind of had this insight that though I was there really to do contemplative practice, mindfulness, meditation, awareness practices, that I was running a company. I had 60 people reporting to me, and I was responsible for budgets, and I was surprised, one, how much I enjoyed the practice of leadership, and I also wondered, why isn't everyone integrating these kind of emotional intelligence, self-awareness practices in with work and leadership? And I decided that's what I wanted to do with my life. And I ended up going to business school so I could get a bit better education in terms of the world of work. And then I started and ran a publishing company, one of the first companies in the world to make things out of recycled paper. We were making.
Oh, how wonderful!
Yeah, and I learned, and in that role, those roles of being, of having 10 years of contemplative practice study, and then 15 years sitting in the seat of a CEO growing a company, those in a way have been the foundation for the rest of my life.
Right.
I've started a couple of company since then.
I want to just get to the practices before we're out of time, because many people listening to this, don't necessarily love their work and they feel stuck. And I want people to hear what the practices are, because you have love the work, do the work, don't be an expert, connect to your pain, connect to the pain of others, depend on others, keep making it simpler and simpler. So explain to us and give us a little bit of these practices, because they're really quite brilliant.
Yeah, I love the they feel both, they're very aspirational and intentional and poetic, and they're also meant to be very practical and something that you could bring into your day-to-day work life and all parts of your life. And I think that starting just to the first one, you know, when I say love the work, I'm not so much referring to the particular job or business or career. I'm referring to the work of cultivating the ability to appreciate your life, the ability to develop one's awareness and not be so caught and tossed around by our stories and emotions. So this is the work, the work of being a more centered, thriving, effective human being. This is what I mean by the work. And of course, part of my own bias is around having a mindfulness practice and meditation practice and all the other practices.
You say that. Right. Have a regular meditation and mindfulness practice. It's really important. Don't be an expert. I love this one. Let go of thinking you are right. Be vulnerable. That's a wonderful one, Mark.
Yeah, and when I understand that nobody likes to be vulnerable. We don't want to be wrong or to fail. But there's something about it takes real confidence in oneself to not always be right. Real confidence to really listen and learn from other people and from our situations. And this is so critical in our businesses and in all of our relationships.
Yes. And then the next one is connect to your pain. And you say, we all goof, transform pain into learning and opportunity.
Yeah, I think this is, again, a core, you know, it's hard growing a company. It's hard being, you know, a human being and not pretending that it isn't. Being more real, being more authentic is the path toward real deeper connection and much
yes.
more effective relationships, and so much of our work lives are around relationship.
And then you have connect to the pain of others. You say don't avoid the pain of others. We're all connected.
Yeah, I think that seeing, really leaning into our common humanity, that that all of us, you know, being a human being is a really tough gig. We're wired to crave, we're wired to need.
Yeah, we are. Hey, we're out of time as well, Mark. What a pleasure talking with you today. You are inspirational, 7 practices of a mindful leader. And where can we get more information? What's the website, please?
Website is marklesser, marklesser.net is where you can find me.
Thank you so much for the work that
you
do
so
and inspiration
yeah,
for all of us. And thank all of you. This has been another edition of the Frankie Boyer Show for Biz Talk Radio. Thanks for listening. Make it a great day. And as always,
smile. Though your heart is aching, smile even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by. If you smile through your fear,